Welcome,
hello,
foolish
hello.
Mortals, to the Haunted Mansion. I'm your host, your ghost host. I'm Savannah.
And I'm Alicia.
And this is Burden of Proof.
That's new.
The Disney Haunted Mansion intro.
Nice. Well, yep. Welcome, everyone.
Welcome back. You made it through Jodi Arias.
Maybe, hopefully.
Yeah, or you skipped. And if you did, that's okay too.
Yes.
Yes.
I'm not sure that this story, well, I mean, there's good, but there's...
It's just different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's okay. I don't know that we have any business because we're recording this ahead of time.
Yes.
So,
I don't think so.
I don't think we have much business today.
Yeah, I don't think so. Alicia, tell us a little bit about how we found this case.
Ah, yes. Well, this was a listener requested. I don't know who originally requested it.
I think it was James.
We think it was James. But we put it up on Patreon and all of our patrons voted out of this case and like two other cases. Mm-hmm. And y'all chose this one. So this is an interesting case. So I will put out this disclaimer, though. This is a survival story. I did my best to focus on the survival story. But I do want to talk about the victims, too.
Yeah.
And like, because they count, too. But her story is pretty incredible. What Lisa McVeigh does is pretty incredible. So
okay.
I hope I do it justice.
All right. I'm sure you will. I have no doubt.
Here we go. Lisa McVeigh's survival story began long before she was abducted. This isn't going to be one of those, she was so innocent and sweet and lit up a room kind of stories. Instead, what I will say is that Lisa was and is almost unbelievably strong, incredibly clever, and undeniably determined, which is what saved her life, not only from the man who abducted her, but from herself.
Okay.
Lisa had already suffered from much trauma prior to being abducted. She said in an interview with A&E that she had been living with her grandmother as a teenager and her grandmother's boyfriend had been sexually abusing her for about 3 years. She felt hopeless as she had nowhere else to go, and she said she felt resolved to kill herself that day, November 3rd, 1984, at just 17 years old. She made a plan to shoot herself that night, wrote a note, and went to work feeling what she described as exhilarated. Because like a weight mm-hmm. was lifted once she made the decision.
Mm-hmm.
She worked a double shift that night at a local donut shop and was riding her bike home at 2 a.m. because Florida, what are child labor laws?
Right. Well, the other thing is, even if you don't have a car in Florida, you can't, like at 17, you can't. I mean, you can if you're coming home from work, I think. Just thinking like the curfew.
Not pretty soon, because they're about to change, roll it back.
Really?
Oh, yeah. They're about to roll it all back.
Oh. So you can just do whatever?
Kind of.
Oh, okay.
They're loosening the laws on what teenagers can do. And they're taking away most of the protections for 16 and 17 year olds.
Mm.
Like the time limits and the
breaks.
Yeah,
the working and stuff.
Yeah. Good times.
Ah, we love it here. Yes, let's overwork the children.
The children. Hey, but if these people would just stop having abortions and have more more labor, like the guy said, I forget what politician said that he implied that we need more laborers.
So stop
having abortions. Yeah.
What in the world? We don't have a labor shortage. We have a you're not paying people enough shortage.
Yeah.
Hey.
So, as Lisa was riding down a rather dark street, she said she noticed a car parked in the church parking lot, which was unusual, but she didn't see an actual person sitting in the car. So she kept riding. At some point, I don't know if it was like as she was passing there or just after, but suddenly from behind, she was yanked off her bike. At first, she screamed and fought back, but the man placed a gun to her head and said, "Shut up or I'll blow your brains out." And Lisa said she was used to that, as it was a tactic often used by her abuser, her grandmother's boyfriend.
Oh my gosh.
She immediately felt survival instincts kick in and the suicidal feelings dissipated. If for no other reason than she wasn't about to let someone else be the one to kill her.
Yeah, that was her choice. I mean,
yeah,
this is so morbid, but like that was her choice. And
yep.
Somebody who's about to be committing a horrific act doesn't get to do that.
Yes. So she told him, quote, "I'll do whatever you want, just don't kill me." The man took her to his car, blindfolded and gagged her and tied her up. She said that when he blindfolded her, she clenched her jaw so that the blindfold would be loose enough.
Mm-hmm.
When she relaxed, she was able to see a little bit. And then as he drove away, she looked around the car for anything that might identify it to police should she live to report it. That alone.
Yeah, it's so incredibly smart.
It's incredible, especially for a 17-year-old.
That's crazy.
She took mental note that the car had white seats, dark red carpet, and the word Magnum on the dashboard.
Those are some attributes.
Yeah.
White seats, red carpet.
Well, it was 1984.
I know.
Keep that in mind.
But still.
So the car was likely, you know, several years old. So it was probably from the 70s. It was a Dodge Magnum. Yeah.
Oh, I thought it just had like the word Magnum for fun.
Oh,
like,
no. That was
the kind of car. You see why I was so shook? I was like, well, that's quite a claim.
No, that was the model of the car.
Okay. Now I feel a little dumb, but.
But they haven't made Dodge Magnums forever. Okay.
I wonder why.
The man stopped the car and ordered her to remove her clothes. She cooperated, thinking to herself that she can make it through one more sexual assault after 3 years of enduring it. But if she makes it out alive, she thought, I will never let this happen again.
Don't say let this, baby.
I know.
This happened to you.
That's what she says in her interview.
Wow.
Is that that's what she thought. He asked her how old she was, and for reasons she doesn't disclose, she lied and said she was 19.
Okay.
The only explanation I can think of is the thought that if he knew, he'd get in more trouble because she was a minor, then he might be even more likely to kill her. Right.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking too.
He then ordered her to perform oral sex, which she did. And then he began driving a further distance. Lisa said she could tell they were on the interstate because the windows were down and the car is sort of rattling from the speed.
Mm-hmm.
She believed they were headed north, and though it felt much longer, they drove about 20 minutes.
Okay.
When he finally stopped, he ordered her to get dressed. He took her by the arm. And as they walked toward their destination, she could see leaves on the ground and suspected they were in or near some woods. They entered what she believed was a building because she could see the carpet and she was counting steps as they walked.
Mm-hmm.
He walked her up a flight of steps, 19 stairs to be exact. And they made a sharp left turn and then a right. And they go into what she believed was an apartment.
Okay.
Once inside, he ordered her to undress again, and he put her in a shower, and then told her not to look at him as he took the blindfold off. He then proceeded to get in the shower with her, and she said it was as if he was living out some sort of fantasy, like they were a normal couple. It was very unusual. He washed her gently. But then suddenly something unknown to her triggered him and he seemed angry all of a sudden.
Hmm.
So he placed the blindfold back on her, threw her to the floor of the bathroom and raped her.
Okay. I'm going to say this doesn't seem like his first time doing this. This feels super ritualistic at this point.
Very good. You get a gold star.
I don't want it. You can take it back.
He then tied her back up, walked her to another room, and placed her on a waterbed. I hate waterbeds. You've probably never even been on one, have you? You haven't
had... I don't think so.
You haven't had the joy of experiencing, like, rolling into a slab of wood and getting stuck between... They're terrible.
Okay.
They're absolutely terrible.
Well, they just don't seem, like, practical anyway.
They're not practical. They're not at all. Not at all. Lisa made a mental note that the apartment smelled very clean and like it had just been painted.
No, that's not a good sign. It's better than it smelling like Dahmer's apartment, I guess.
Yeah, that's true. The man would periodically drag the gun across her to let her know he still had it so she wouldn't fight. And in between, he repeatedly raped her in, quote, in her words, quote, every way you can imagine that a person could be raped. During short breaks between, he would talk to her, and she was very good at saying what she believed he wanted to hear to stay on his good side. At one point, he took her to the living room, gave her a sandwich and sodas, and suddenly a news report interrupted the TV show to announce a 17-year-old girl named Lisa is missing.
Awkward.
She said that reality set in for a moment, and as she began screaming and crying again, he placed the gun to her head and said, quote, if you scream one more time, I'll be forced to put a bullet in your head. Stop crying. She said his use of the word forced was confirmation that he likely didn't want to kill her.
Right.
When he took her back to the bedroom to rape her some more, he began to get more intimate. She said he put her hands on his face, which allowed her to feel what he looked like. She could feel he had a mustache, pockmarks, and could feel the shape of his nose. He then let her get up and use the bathroom at some point, which she took the opportunity to strategically leave fingerprints all over just in case he did end up killing her. And when she had another opportunity to talk some more, she asked him why he was doing this to her, to which he replied that it was to get back at women in general because of a recent breakup.
So we have an incel. This is horrible.
Lisa then gave him a sob story about her father being ill and that she was his only caregiver, so he needs her. All lies.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but it's smart of her because he would care about a man.
It was genius. Yes.
So smart.
Oh, you're so spot on. Another gold star.
Oh my gosh, I'm collecting them now.
26 hours from the time he abducted her, the man ordered Lisa to get dressed again and asked her where she lived. He said he was taking her home. She didn't believe him. She thought he was going to kill her.
Yeah.
But she cooperated because, again, he could kill her right then. She doesn't know. The man drove to an ATM and Lisa could see enough that she was pretty sure she knew where they were and what bank it was. So she made a mental note of that, as well as that he was wearing a white t-shirt, jeans, and white sneakers.
A lot of white.
Well, he loves white.
White seats, white t-shirt, white sneakers, white jeans.
Yeah. He then stopped at a gas station, and before going inside, he told Lisa that if she tried to yell, he would kill the clerk and then kill her. Finally, he pulls into a parking lot and said, quote, tell your father he's the reason I didn't kill you.
I hate it. Why? I mean, I know why, but it's just so dumb that he has more respect for a man he doesn't know than the woman that his life, that he's just ruined her life. I mean, not that I'm saying her life is ruined, but like she's going to struggle with this forever.
Yeah.
He committed atrocities. Her life's not ruined. She's going to have a life.
No, but I'm not, any survivor of something, of any sort of sexual right. assault can testify to right. like your life is
altered.
Altered, different.
Yes.
I mean, yes, you can do all the therapies to heal, but you just are never quite the same. The man then instructed her to wait 5 minutes after he left to take the blindfold off. Lisa has stated in interviews that when she took the blindfold off, she looked up to see the branches of beautiful oak trees, and all she could think was that I'm going to have a new life and it will be better.
Good. Duran Duran.
She ran all the way back to her grandmother's, having no idea just how close she really was to death's door. Her rapist wasn't just some heartbroken schlub that thought raping a young girl would make him feel better about being dumped. He was none other than the now infamous serial killer, Bobby Joe Long.
Really? Wow.
Yes.
I've heard that name, but I've never really, like, looked into the story.
Yeah. Now, Lisa's story was what was requested, like I said in the beginning. And I want to strive to tell her story and focus on the victims as well. But, like, how can you really grasp the immensity of her survivor story without knowing who this guy is,
right, yeah,
and what his story is. So we're going to talk a little bit about Bobby's story. Bobby Joe Long was born on October 14th, 1953 in West Virginia. And as many serial killers do, he had a rather troubled upbringing. His parents divorced when he was very young, and his mother, Luella, then moved him to Florida. It's said that Luella worked in a bar and was often bringing different men home with her, which must have been especially problematic if the report that Bobby shared a bed with her until he was 12 or 13
oh my gosh.
Is in fact true. There's speculation on it.
Okay.
Including from Bobby's future wife. So.
Yeah. It's
probably true. Luella was also known for being rather controlling and bullyish towards Bobby. Not surprisingly, this is believed to be the origin story of his hatred of women. Bobby actually met his future wife, Cindy, around that same age, 13 years old. And after dating for 7 years, the couple married in 1974 at just 20 and 21 years old.
All right.
Reportedly, Bobby's nature was that of volatility, but a serious motorcycle accident just a few months after their wedding made it so much worse.
Aha, we have head trauma.
Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, the couple went on to have 2 children. Cindy has said that she doesn't believe the brain injury from the accident caused Bobby to become the way he did, because there were signs of abuse even prior to them getting married. So, it's likely he still would have been abusive.
Yeah.
Would he have been as triggered or as abusive? It's hard to say. Cindy actually believes that the accident just sort of knocked loose the screw that was holding everything together, causing him to just become more dangerous. He would grow hostile every time Cindy did not comply to his demands. For example, he insisted she wash the dishes as soon as she'd finished dinner. And when she refused, he got up and threw all the dishes in the garbage.
I mean, that's one way of handling it. Not a great way.
So you run out of dishes.
Yeah, you just have to keep buying dishes.
Hostility grew into abuse, when he began pinning her down by sitting on her chest with his knees on her shoulders, and then would smack her in the face repeatedly, which eventually escalated into choking. The abuse grew even more dangerous for Cindy, leaving her with a broken nose multiple times, bruises, stitches, etc. He apparently had also developed a compulsive and dangerous sex drive that crime analysts have labeled as sexual sadism.
Okay. I don't know much about that.
Well, he likes to choke people. He gets off on harming them as he's having sex with them, basically. Mm-hmm. Cindy doesn't talk about it, so we don't really know, mm-hmm. like, was he like that with her too? Or just in what's to come?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. In 1980, Cindy filed for divorce after an incident where Bobby picked her up by the throat and slammed her head against the TV so hard that she was knocked out. She woke up to him sitting over her crying. He began the textbook abuser's plea of apologies coupled with blame. You know, if you wouldn't have provoked me, I wouldn't have to do this. The gash in her head needed stitches, so he allowed her to go to the hospital, but warned her that if she told them what happened, he would kill her. So she tried to lie to the doctor by saying she tripped over a toy and fell into the corner of the TV. The doctor excused himself, came back with a police officer, and when she tried to stick to that lie, the officer reached into his pocket, pulled out a mirror, and said, "Did that toy have hands?" She had bruises on her neck in the perfect shape of handprints.
This is when I'm glad people do their freaking jobs.
Mm-hmm. So she admitted that it was Bobby, and the officer said he was going to arrest him. She pleaded with him not to, explaining that she knew he would get out before she had time to get somewhere safe. And he had threatened to kill her, which she believed wholeheartedly that mm-hmm. he would.
And she had good reason to.
Yes. So the officer told her that he would give her a week, and that if she had not left and filed for divorce, he was going to arrest Bobby anyway. So she went home, placated Bobby as much as possible, and filed with the help of an attorney who worked in her employer's legal department.
I'm glad she was able to find somebody to help her do that.
Yeah. On the brink of divorce, Bobby moved in with a female friend named Sharon Richards. Sharon later accused him of rape and battery, but it wasn't until 1983 that he would see any consequences. He was arrested after sending an inappropriate letter and nude photographs to a 12-year-old girl. He was in jail for only 2 days and then placed on probation.
What the hell? What? What? I am angry.
Yes.
That's infuriating. That's one of the worst sentences. Like, that's one of the worst things I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm. He left Florida for a while after that happened and worked as various x-ray technician jobs, but never for very long. Bobby then made the leap to serial rapist, answering classified ads for items being sold as opportunities to catch unsuspecting women alone in their homes. And I guess I should add, this began after he came back to Florida.
Okay.
He had moved, I forget where, back to West Virginia or something for a time. But then he came back, and this is when he started this whole classified ads business. He became known as the classified ad rapist, and police believe he committed more than 50 rapes across South Florida through the early 1980s. But in fact, it was likely going on longer than that. According to Cindy, Bobby would make excuses to leave the house at night when they were married, and he had ample opportunity to commit such crimes during the day while she was at work. He had also been accused of rape by one of Cindy's co-workers when they were still married, but due to the woman's reputation, the police believed him that it was consensual.
Smack him upside the head.
This was like a coworker that she literally sat right next to. So she ended up leaving that job because she was so uncomfortable not knowing, but like thinking, well, you had an affair with my husband.
Mm.
Anyway, it's not really a stretch to believe he was a serial rapist while still married, but really amped it up once divorced and unable to take out his anger on Cindy regularly. He was never formally charged with any of these rapes for a couple of reasons. One, it's believed most of the victims who never reported the rape because, well, the same reason women haven't reported rape since the beginning of time.
Because he gets 2 days in jail and then is released on probation for crap like that.
Yeah. They won't be believed. They'll be shamed for it. And he won't be caught, won't get charged, or will get nothing more than, like you said, 2 days.
And you have to
slap on the wrist.
And you have to relive it to do that. And it doesn't go. It's so, the system is so messed up.
Yep. Or number two, they just proved the first group of victims' reasoning. They reported it, but then he was never actually caught or charged.
Right.
When he got close to getting caught, though, that's when things escalated even further. In his confession, when they finally caught him, Bobby admitted that the reason he started killing his victims was because one of the previous victims had the audacity to report her rape, and he almost got caught.
It's sickening. It really is. I mean, how dare she? Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Chop off his balls. I mean,
you will want to.
I want to now.
Yeah.
What do you even say to that?
I don't know. It's bad.
Wow.
I did not know going into this when it was requested that she was the survivor of him.
Yeah.
Like, I had heard about him, but I didn't remember her name and stuff. And so this was all very, yeah. But I'm, unfortunately, this is where I'm going to stop because I think it's a good stopping
point
before we get into the victims that he actually ends up killing.
He has some freaking cojones to act like that. I mean, just ridiculous. And she's amazing.
Yeah, she is impressive. And when you hear where she ends up, you're like, yep, that makes sense. Yeah.
I can't wait to hear because I'm so impressed by her ability and her quick thinking. And she was so smart and she saved her own life. And that's amazing.
Yeah. Especially back then, like at a time when it wasn't like today, if a teenager did all that, it's not that I wouldn't credit them for it when you're in the midst of a traumatic thing happening. Absolutely. But I think teenagers today are just so much better informed because of true crime being out, because of just they're exposed to so much more as far as like the news and media and whatever than we were back then. And so it's truly a testament as to just who she is and like what she's really like, her instincts are really good, coupled probably with the trauma that she had already endured. But yeah, I was blown away that she would think to do all of those things, to pay attention to all those little details.
Yeah. I mean, from the minute it began, she was on it.
Yeah. Wild.
Mm-hmm. I enjoy hearing the story from the survivor perspective first.
Mm-hmm.
Because it really, I think, puts it into perspective as to how bad he was.
Yeah. I struggled at first as to, like, how am I going to write this? How do I, mm-hmm. like, how do I start this? Because, you know, I've done a serial killer case before, well, a couple of them, and you tend to focus, like most serial killer cases we do. We focus on the serial killer themselves.
Because they're the central. They're, you know, that's...
Yeah, because it's hard to tell the story from any other perspective. This I found interesting.
Because I'm good. Like, okay. Yeah.
So we're going to get back to Lisa's story at the end. Like, okay. Well, I started with her and I'll end with her.
Okay.
But yeah, I wanted, how do you tell her story and understanding the immensity of what she went through, as I said.
Wow.
Unless you know just how terrible mm-hmm. this man was. So.
Well.
Sorry to cut it short. We have to spread these things out over the month of March. Otherwise,
yeah, but I think it's good. I think it gives her a moment in our minds to really to linger on her survival. I think that's important too. And if you like survivor stories, we have a few that you can listen to while you wait for the next part. We have Susan Walters. She's the woman who killed her hitman. We mm-hmm. have
Heather Grossman.
We have Brandi Hicks. And Liz Reiser. So you have several options if you want more in this vein, but it's definitely a good niche of true crime.
Yeah.
For us, I think.
I like survivor stories.
Mm-hmm.
Now I want to start singing Destiny's Child.
I know you do.
But I won't. I will spare you all from my terrible singing voice.
Well, we will pick this up next week. I'm excited to hear... I mean, I'm not excited, but I am excited to see where Lisa ends up.
Yes. All right. Well, if you've made it this far, thank you for listening. And go ahead and leave us a tree emoji on our social media pages and you will get a Sunday shout out.
Yeah, baby. Sunday shout outs.
So, yeah. Sorry to leave you hanging, but you'll listen to us next week.
You will.
March. Sorry to say, we'll catch you next week, but you'll catch us.
You'll catch us.
Catch us next week.
In the month of two-parters.
All right. Till next time, guys.
Till next time. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening, guys. Find us on Instagram and TikTok at Burden of Proof Pod and email us at burdenofproofpod@gmail.com.